Good evening and welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And mine's Philip Coppens.
And we are going to get very revolutionary tonight. We're going to talk about revolutions in history, revolutions in spirituality. We're going to talk about some of the bad girls of history who maybe weren't really bad girls after all, but have been given a bad rap. My current favorite poster girl for this idea is Anne Boleyn. So we're going to talk a lot about her because today is an important sort of anniversary in the history of Anne Boleyn lore. And also because the Daily Mail in the UK ran a horrific article today about Anne Boleyn, which we're going to chat about. Because there's a lot of things going on, again, with denigrating women in history. And this is becoming, you know, kind of a sport in modern times. It's almost like we're regressing in terms of the way we are looking at women historically. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about who writes history and how, not like the show we did a few weeks ago. This one's going to be a little bit different. We're going to talk about things like Wikipedia and what a really sort of scary media event Wikipedia has become. We read today that, 7% of internet users refer to Wikipedia every day. I'm certainly guilty of it. I will go to Wiki when I see something because, first of all, it's the first thing that comes up when you Google something. But what I emphasize to everybody is if Wikipedia is where you end up first, don't stop there. You cannot assume that everything you read on Wikipedia is correct. And this is something you certainly care about and have written articles about. So we're going to get into that a little bit. And we're also going to talk about the fact that I'm in trouble again. My mouth and my opinions often get me into trouble in the so-called spiritual community who get very upset with me for speaking my mind. So we're going to talk about that too. Is it unspiritual to be honest when you think something is unjust? Is it unspiritual to speak your mind? Is it unloving to criticize something that you think has a negative effect on society? Because that's what my spiritual sisters would certainly have me believe. And I don't agree with them. So we're going to have a little chat about that. And we're going to talk about this whole concept of the sisterhood. And this is going to bring us back full circle to Anne Boleyn and to the fact that some of Anne Boleyn's biggest detractors in history have, in fact, been female historians. So this is all stuff I want to work with today. And I hope you'll hang in here with us because I think it's going to be a very interesting and maybe a little controversial discussion.
And just to set it up, it's today, February the 23rd, and in 1536, two men, one an ambassador to the English court by the name of Chapuis, and the other Thomas Cromwell, who was very intimate with both Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, they both came together shortly after Anne Boleyn had her third miscarriage, and they decided to basically do away with her. For reasons which history has not made clear, they really wanted to get her out of the picture so that Henry could move on to another wife. Now, that is the crux of the matter. There are documents which suggest that Henry VIII was involved and aware, and that he basically asked these two men to get rid of his second wife. Now, when you are looking at some of the recent history books which have been written about Anne Boleyn, then you begin to see that really this fact of these two men, if not three men, conspiring to get rid of a woman, a queen of England, is reported, but it's never made or given the airtime and the exposure which it should. Because here we have a conspiracy, something to do away with this woman. Yet it is always reported, and more so, and once again today in the Daily Mail, that Anne Boleyn's downfall was all due to herself. She allegedly slept around with men. She allegedly had an incestuous relationship with her brother. And because of all of these things, because of her sexual nature or the fact that she could not control her sexual urges, somehow this literally cost her head. Whereas the problems which Henry had are kind of like highlighted, but somehow seem to be okay.
The amazing thing about the Anne Boleyn story is this. When you dig into the historical evidence and the documentation, what you see overwhelmingly is that there is no evidence whatsoever that Anne was ever unfaithful to Henry at all. There is no evidence that Anne ever slept with anybody in her entire life other than her husband. But that's not a fun picture for us historically, is it? We live in this tabloid culture who finds it far juicier to believe that Anne might have had all these affairs, even though it was absolutely impossible for her to have done so. What becomes important is this. And I talk about this with Mary Magdalene. It's the same case with Mary Magdalene as it is with Anne Boleyn. And I'm fond recently of saying that Anne Boleyn is the new Mary Magdalene. And what I mean by that is this. We know that Mary Magdalene was not a prostitute and is not a fallen woman. Even the church admits that, and they've admitted that since since 1969. And yet, you can go to a church anywhere in the world during Holy Week and hear a sermon about Mary Magdalene, the repentant sinner, and the fallen woman. Old habits die hard. Once a woman has been tarred with that brush, once she has been labeled the fallen woman, the prostitute, the schemer, or, you know, in any way dirty, she is never able to come clean. And that is the tragedy of history, because so many powerful, important women have been damaged and denigrated by labeling them like this, that it has completely erased their absolute contribution to history. And that's what it's supposed to do, isn't it? I mean, that is the idea. If we stay so focused on Anne Boleyn as schemer, as adulteress, as so outrageous that she would have sex with her own brother, and some of these biographers and novelists take the point of view that, well, she had to have a son and the king was impotent, so she had sex with her own brother because it was safe. He wouldn't tell on her, but she could at least conceive that way and have a son and convince Henry that was... I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of scheming that people put onto Anne in order to make up this sensational story. And you have to go back and ask yourself why. Is it just because we can't get enough of the sensationalism, or is there something else at play here? And what I want to propose is that Anne Boleyn is such an incredibly important character, was such an amazingly powerful woman, was instrumental in causing the Reformation, not just because Henry had to divorce Catherine of Aragon to be with her, but because Anne was herself a passionate advocate of reform. They don't want us to look at that. History does not want us to see that part of Anne, and has eliminated so much of the documentation that would have defended Anne or shown us who she was. And as a result, what we are left with is the garbage that was created to discredit her. And this is the cycle of history with women. It is so frustrating.
And when you just go into history, you find that the same techniques and the same kind of memories are attached to Hatshepsut in ancient Egypt, Cleopatra, who somehow is this vicious woman who is even willing to kill her own sister just to move up in the world. It's a repetition whereby I think you're asking the question, could men get away with this and can women not? And I think in the case of King Henry VIII, it's the fact that he is somehow portrayed as a bit of a buffoon, and he was this and he was that, but he is always seen as weak, and to some extent that's okay. Kind of like that's as far as people will go. But actually what they should see Henry is a person who potentially killed his own wife. And for whatever reason that is a real important issue which historians do not seem to be willing to address, and instead go for the easy option of like, oh, it's all Anne Boleyn's fault. And so often, in the case of Cleopatra, in the case of Hatshepsut, in so many cases, Nefertiti, all of these things, the women have to bear the burden for quite often male, but also, as we are seeing with Anne Boleyn, female historians unwilling to go and do the hard work and actually tell history the way it is supposed to be written, in all of its complexity, but also in all of its beauty.
What's really frustrating for me as a woman reading female history is reading how many female historians seem intent, even passionate, about preserving these horrific portraits of these powerful women. I went on a rant this week publicly about Alison Weir. Well, Alison Weir is considered one of the great British royal biographers. She's certainly one of the best-selling. She's one of the most well-known. And as a result, she gets away with murder. And her books are a mess in terms of accuracy. You know, I've coined a phrase this week, truth autopsy. I'm going to do a truth autopsy on Alison Weir's book on Anne Boleyn. She had a big book come out about Anne Boleyn about 6 months ago called A Lady in the Tower. And, you know, I mean, well, Philip, you were with me as we've read through this together. I mean, how many times have I thrown that book against the wall this week? It is so biased and so absolutely dismissive of any fact that proves Anne to be a decent person. Weir celebrates the fact that she gets to go to conferences and speak about, quote, the whore. Weir celebrates the fact that she gets to call Anne the whore, and goes after this without ever saying that any of this evidence was, you know, clearly trumped up. It was extracted under torture. Weir just accepts all of these things, and not only that, then turns around and makes a case for Henry as an innocent. I just find it outrageous. You know, there's an old expression in Ireland that says, when you have the name of an early riser, you can sleep till noon. And that's what's happening here with quote, historians like Alison Weir. She has the name of being a reputable historian, and as a result, she can get away with the most schlocky, slothful scholarship I have ever seen in print in a history book, and everyone accepts it as fact. So I am here to say, people, be discerning. If you are going to read history books, read more than one. Get multiple opinions, because none of these books are unbiased. And the great example is this piece of information that's coming out today from a, quote, Tudor scholar.
That's right. I mean, first of all, going back to Alison Weir, I started circling on the first 30 pages just the amount of coulds and probably and it is likely which she uses to build up her argument. And all of that is really sloppy research, and an editor or whoever should actually expose and say, hold on here, every sentence has a could or a probably in it. That's not a scientific argument. It, you know, everything is possible, and you can build an entire theory as such. And she has been called upon for being sloppy with her sources. And what is happening with George Bernard today on Anne Boleyn is somewhat similar and also somewhat different. And what he's been doing is he has a book coming out in May, and the book is really just a reiteration of an argument he has been having with other Anne Boleyn scholars, specifically Eric Ives. And the argument has been going on since 1992 at least. And it is this continuous repetition and reiteration of something which somehow is served to the media in a new format. And it's one of these things which greatly disturbs me, because it's a technique which not only he uses, but a lot of other scientists and archaeologists use, which is dishing up something which they couldn't get away with 10 years ago, but all of a sudden they try it again. And the most famous example of what I have seen is actually Zahi Hawass, yep, him again, who sometimes gives press conferences in front of monuments which have nothing to do with the actual discovery he is announcing. And then he announces something which he actually announced 10 to 15 years ago already. And nobody takes him to task for this. And again, we have, with George Bernard on Anne Boleyn, the same argument whereby he gets massive airtime to promote his book, to say something which isn't new, and pretty much gets a safe run all the way to the end, whereby David Starkey, who is one of Britain's most notorious illustrators of the Tudor period, specifically for a TV audience, who says, well, I do not agree with him, but he is a very respectable author and historian. He's an expert, so there must be something to his argument. And it's what's missing from David Starkey there is actually what David Starkey probably knows to be true, which is that this is an old argument and that it's an argument which George Bernard is trying to push onto an international scene for a very long time and is failing to get that established. And it's what gets you into trouble is that you call these people and say, this isn't a new argument, this is based on nothing, this is pretty much a lie. But that gets you into trouble, and David Starkey is unwilling to go there. But as such, this karmic law of continuous repetition of fallacies just seems to be happening, because nobody is calling George Bernard on it. Nobody's calling Zahi Hawass on it. Nobody is calling so many scientists on their BS.
Well, and I'm calling George Bernard on it, and I don't care who likes it. But that's part of the point too. The point is, when you call somebody out, you become the bad guy, right? And I'm going to make this case, which is, I think, because I am a woman who calls out people on this kind of behavior and on these lies of history, that I am less likely to get away with it than a man. It's the same old story. When a woman speaks her mind, she's a bitch. When a man speaks his mind, he's strong. He's a leader. But when a woman does it, forget it. It's a whole nother story. And that is something I chafe against every single day, and will continue to do so. And the other piece of that that is particularly painful for me is that my detractors, my critics, the people who tell me that I don't have the right to speak like that because it's judgmental and it's negative, and how dare I call myself a spiritual person if I'm going to say these negative things, they're all women. They're all women. My, quote, spiritual sisters out in the world will come after me for being strong and speaking my mind. And that, I think, is particularly tragic. And also, you know, there is a real sad element to this, which is that they don't even have the faintest glint of the irony that they are accusing me of being judgmental as they judge me. But judge me if you will. I am going to speak the truth when I see something has been ridiculously unjust in history. And in this case, what George Bernard is doing, what the Daily Mail is repeating, is a problem. It is unjust because it's propaganda, it's tabloid trash, and yet the whole world is looking at it. I received 10 different copies of the same article today from people who said to me, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Have you seen this? Now, I'm not blaming them. I'm grateful that people send these things to me and they want me to see it. They want to make sure that I have. But it shows you how out in the media this article, Anne Boleyn, new proof that Anne Boleyn is a whore, new proof that Anne had incest with her brother. I got an article in my inbox today that was titled, Anne Boleyn had incest with her brother, or committed incest with her brother. And I'm like, oh my God, are we doing this again? And to your point, the Daily Mail and George Bernard are making the case that this is new. He has new evidence to prove this. There is new evidence to prove this, which is why it's in the news now. And that's the lie, okay? That's the deception that is coming from history and from the media. The deception is that they're trying to make you believe that there is new evidence that this woman really is the whore that everyone said she is, really was the incestuous creature that everyone said she is, because there's new evidence. And what's everyone throwing around? This idea of George Bernard is a, quote, Tudor scholar, an accepted academic. He is a professor. They're calling him Professor George Bernard. So as a result, we all just need to accept that this is a fact and move on. And that is not going to happen as long as I have breath in my body. This information that George Bernard is using against Anne is so old, there is nothing new about it. The poem that he's quoting, the letter that he is claiming backs up the poetry, it's all been discredited 1,000 times over 20 years, over hundreds of years. None of this is new. It's just being reprocessed and repackaged because now it is historically profitable to talk about Anne Boleyn as a whore. Anne Boleyn as a whore is a merchandising phenomenon. Anne Boleyn is a virtuous woman who was butchered by her husband and by the state is not nearly as interesting as the tabloid Anne Boleyn, who we see in The Other Boleyn Girl and who we see on The Tudors. That's the Anne Boleyn that people want to read about. That's juicy. It's disgusting. It's unfair. And it needs to stop.
And all of this kind of like also began to look at who is defining history and who is writing. And George Bernard is the Tudor expert. He somehow has legitimate case because he is an expert in Tudor history. But a lot of the books on Anne Boleyn have been written by women like Alison Weir, Antoni Fraser, Joanne Denny. And some of these people have got some scientific qualifications, but then also you have a Philippa Gregory who has very much portrayed Anne Boleyn and her sister, the Mary, the other Boleyn girl, in another fictionalized setting. And once again, all of this becomes a very big muddle of facts. Who are the experts? Who are the ones who have written millions of best-selling books on this period? And to some extent, this is also the role where Wikipedia comes in, because what Wikipedia has done is it has allowed the likes of you and I and everybody who has internet access to go out there and start writing and trying to right wrongs if you feel that certain people in history have been misjudged, and Wikipedia seems to be a means of doing that. You can say anything you want. You can go in and edit it for yourself. Now, you and I both have had problems with Wikipedia, and specifically skeptics, that wonderful creature which lives in zoo and never comes out, and they treat things like Wikipedia as prime hunting grounds to go after character assassinations. And that is just not on the living, it's also on the dead. And in 2007, I wrote about Wikipedia and how, together with Google, they were creating this extremely dangerous problem, which I called Googlepedia, because all the information of what seemed to be worthy, what Google was representing, seemed to be on Wikipedia. And in 2007, there was a serious problem. And the problem was this, that people began to realize that Wikipedia had created certain editors, some of whom were less than reputable, and some of whom had contacted Wikipedia with fake scientific credentials. That some people were using Wikipedia to spread disinformation, and that some people were actually being harmed by this. There was one Turkish person who, as a result, was labeled a terrorist for what somebody had maliciously put on his Wikipedia profile page, and who was arrested and denied entrance into certain countries. At that moment in time, there was actually a very young guy called Virgil Griffiths, if I remember correctly, who created a tool which was called the Wiki Scanner. And what he tried to do was this. He tried to find out where these people who were editing Wikipedia were located. And he found that people like the BBC actually were editing their own Wikipedia entries. They were lessening and softening. He found that the Vatican was interfering with the Wikipedia entry about Jerry Adams. He found that the CIA was objecting to certain things to do with the CIA and spreading certain information which should not be called information at all, but should be dissed and treated as disinformation. He found an intriguing network of how history was actively being rewritten, but also how somehow these people who were rewriting history were given this opportunity whereby the likes of you or I were actually disallowed from editing our own wiki entry. And this was not just something which was happening to you or I, this was happening to the Turkish person, Jack Sarfati, who Wikipedia had labeled a pseudo-physicist, had the same problem. Thousands, if not millions, of people were somehow subjected to being denied the access to their own information and putting right basic wrongitudes about what was appearing on Wikipedia. So we are living in a world where Wikipedia, 2 years on, or 3 years on almost, seems to have forgotten what was all the wrongs of two and 3 years ago. And many of these wrongs still haven't been rectified. When you go to my Wikipedia entry, you will still see that there is a warning there placed by a person involved with the Rennes Le Chateau mystery who had a personal bee in his bonnet against me and convinced Wikipedia that I was not an impartial person when it came to kind of like me writing what kind of books I had published. or my date of birth, and all of these things. So there is this thing going on whereby not just us, we are subjected to this, but it's all of this, how people are being treated. And it's a very interesting concept. And like you, I have stood up, and you are a person who defends women. I tend to defend ancient monuments who cannot speak for themselves, and this lost civilizations who have nobody to speak for themselves either. And I quite often find that how these, the people involved, the people who are trying to change that, whether they men or women, how they are subjected, because as you say, it is so easy to shoot the messenger, and the messenger gets so much shot at for reasons which really makes you question what it is that moves people so much that they do not want to see a very interesting story involving Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII.
Well, and this is the tragedy, really, is that the story that we're missing, whether it is the true story of Mary Magdalene, or the true story of Marie Antoinette, or the true story of Lucrezia Borgia, or in this case, the true story of Anne Boleyn, what we're missing are fantastic, enriching, enlightening, amazing stories about women who changed the world. And that's my passion. My passion is cutting through the dross, exposing the lies, so that we can peel those layers back and let the truth shine forward, and really see these women in a new light, and really look at how difficult it was to be a woman in that period of time with an opinion. Hell, it's difficult to be a woman in the 21st century with an opinion. I am criticized for it almost every day. I can't even imagine what it must have been like in a time when speaking your mind as a woman was either going to end up with you tied to a stake or with no head. And that's what we're looking at. And so that's my passion. My passion is to eliminate the lies, not for the sake of being negative, not because I'm judgmental, but because I believe that history needs to be corrected so that we can let these women, and not just white women, but men and characters and events in history that have been forgotten, come forward so that they can inspire us in a new way. And they deserve that. You know, this is something that deserves to happen. And, you know, it's the old expression that if we don't learn from history, we're destined to repeat it. And it's certainly happening over and over again.
And it's actually something which is happening right now, because I was looking at books to do with 2012 in preparation for a project. And while reading a book about 2012, all of a sudden, I was confronted with this statement as to how Hillary Clinton was supposed to be the Illuminati queen. And it brings back this entire concept of the Illuminati, which is that from a historical point of view, the Illuminati were a secret society in Bavaria who lived for a while and then seemed to have disappeared and never to be heard of again. And when it comes to this idea that there is this undercurrent in history, the Illuminati have been resurrected from the dead and are now everywhere. And just imagine 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, or 500 years from now, that this book on 2012 mentions Hillary Clinton as an Illuminati queen. And just think that how this is going to be represented. All of a sudden, we would have like a similar controversy to do with Anne Boleyn, that somehow Hillary Clinton is far worse and far more dangerous than she really is. And it's a very difficult kind of subject to talk about, because it brings up this notion that somehow, you know, when you talk about conspiracies, it's a two-edged cutting sword, because on the one hand, yes, there are conspiracies, they are left, right, and center, but it also seems to be the case that every conspiracy which is outed and which is discussed is actually the wrong one. It's a very bizarre concept that people seem to fall for the fake conspiracy rather than for the correct one. And it's something which I have never been able to get my mind around. People are willing to talk endlessly about Mary Magdalene and her relationship with Jesus, but as soon as you try to change the debate and actually say, well, but okay, let's move on and let's just agree whether you agree that they are married or just had a very special relationship. What was that relationship about? What were they doing? All of a sudden, people seem to be unwilling to go there. They just want to have this very basic information, as you're pointing out, this tabloid junkie kind of stuff. No, no, let's just debate whether this or whether that happened. Now, when it comes to sleeping around, Hillary Clinton's husband was a man and a president, and his end presidency, the last few years of his presidency, were overshadowed by his affair or alleged affair with Monica Lewinsky, and specifically how the Republicans went after him. And when you look at the way history is treating him right now, you definitely feel that if he had been a woman, he would not be the senior statesman he is right now. He would literally have been wiped off the political scene and not be around and doing the work he is doing.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. No woman could get away with it. That's just the way it is. With the possible exception of, you take, say, a woman like Madonna, someone who has sort of built a career and a legacy and a reputation as being outrageous. Okay, there are women who step into that role of being outrageous, and they say that that's who they are and that's who they're going to be, and they get away with it. But that has to be your persona in order to do that. You have to be an outrageous rock star in order to get away with it. If you're a woman, who wants to be taken seriously as an author, even as an actor, certainly as a politician, as a businesswoman, just can't have those same kinds of indiscretions. It's just, there is a double standard, and there's always going to be one, unfortunately. And again, these are the things that take us away from the idea of women as, you know, creating monumental, extraordinary legacies in history, because so many of them have been forgotten. And, you know, it's not even just about promiscuity. I mean, women who are overtly sensual, in any manner, to this day are often discriminated against. Or, you know, it's to be a woman who is in touch with your sexuality is still a controversial thing in the 21st century. It's still something, you know, if I write about Hieros Gamos, I write about divine union. Well, when I talk about it, I have to always kind of pull back a little bit and think, all right, well, I'm a mother. I have kids. Do my kids want to hear me talking about this kind of thing? You know, maybe I shouldn't talk about it. I should keep it within the pages of my book. You know, these are things that we have to kind of back off on. So, I'm getting a little bit off topic now, but this whole concept of sexuality and women in history and in the present is problematic. But to your point, it is certainly a double standard. Women cannot get away with what men can. So, for example, we're talking about Anne Boleyn, and, you know, the George Bernards and the Alison Weirs are thrilled to say that she slept around and she was promiscuous, and somehow make it okay that, you know, Henry had her butchered. But no one talks about Henry's peccadilloes, do they? No one talks about how many women Henry went through, how quickly he was bored, how many affairs he had, how many mistresses, you know. I mean, they do, I'm not going to say that they don't talk about it, they do, but it's not really with any kind of condemnation. We kind of look at Henry as a character from history, don't we? Whereas we look at women in a completely different light. It's time to change this. It's time to get rid of these labels. It's time to sort of strip all of that away and also look at women in history as, you know, as people who were really trying to accomplish something under incredibly difficult circumstances. The Cleopatra issue is a really important one. I was on a British Airways flight coming back from Europe a few months ago, and they were showing a documentary, and it was a very good documentary, except it was called Cleopatra, Portrait of a Killer. And the documentary was about finding the remains of Cleopatra's sister, which is a very interesting story, finding the remains of her younger sister in a tomb in Ephesus. But then the documentary basically goes on to try to prove that Cleopatra had her sister murdered, of which, by the way, there is absolutely no evidence. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. But it's a dramatic story, isn't it? Cleopatra as, you know, this horrific woman who would do anything. You know, she had these lovers, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony. So here we have, again, the notorious woman. And of course, it's her sexuality that makes her notorious, right? She seduced these men, you know. So this is the image that we have of this sexy, smart woman. Again, femme fatale. She's dangerous. And of course, if we're going to believe that she has all of this, you know, sexual energy, the next step is that we also believe that she is a schemer and a conniver and can certainly murder her sister if that's what it takes to achieve her ambitions. And this concept that sexuality and evil is conflated with women scares me a lot. And it's something that I think is, you know, again, even in the 21st century, we have not moved past that. And it's something that needs to be looked at and discussed. Now, on the Cleopatra issue, what I wanted to say is this. Cleopatra, in her time, was a woman who was incredibly powerful. She was the ruler of this incredibly powerful and influential kingdom, and she was a woman. And that was a very, very difficult thing to be, to stay in that place, to protect her people, to protect her kingdom and her family, required so much more intelligence, integrity, courage than we could ever imagine, that it would not have taken if a man had held that position. So I think in these cases, we have to cut these women a lot of slack. We don't know what it took to survive as a woman over 2,000 years ago, much less survive as a woman who was trying to lead a nation.
And when you look at these four women, Nefertiti, Cleopatra, Mary Magdalene, and Anne Boleyn, you find that all four of them are very much very interesting characters of history. And that kind of brings it back to the Spirit Revolution, because all of these people were spiritual revolutionaries, quite often with their husbands. It wasn't all in all of the women as a solo career, but Cleopatra is very interesting from another aspect, which is that she was the last of a line. She literally was treated in Egypt as the goddess Isis incarnate. She was Egypt. She had this ancient concept that humanity and the gods melted together, and she incorporated this visually. And it's something which is so powerful that historians just kind of like treat it as if, oh, you know, this was just another poor deluded woman who was trying to do something and trying to do this. She knew that thousands of years of Egyptian tradition bore upon her shoulders. I can't even begin to feel how it would be if you're treated as a deity. But the one thing I would say is you've got to cut a woman like that some slack. It's a bit like Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was a child star from the ages of 5. Sure enough, he had an awful lot of psychological problems as a result, because he never had a normal life. He never had a normal childhood, because he has and was a golden child from the very word go. Now imagine if you are treated like that from a very young age, and none of these people who are quick to judge Cleopatra not even take that into consideration. You will not even find these interesting things. You know, so we immediately go for the bashing of these people. But taking it back to the Spirit Revolution, I think that women are, those four women, Nefertiti, Cleopatra, Mary Magdalene, and Anne Boleyn, really are the people who are prostituted by historians, because if you peel away the layer of, oh, this is a woman who slept around, what you're actually beginning to find is that these women were spirit revolutionaries. These women, Anne Boleyn, was a Protestant reformer. She was preparing England from a Catholic nation into a Protestant nation. What she was doing was peeling back centuries of false Catholic dogma and say, actually, the church is not about this, it's about something else. And I think that is where the 21st century is failing as a whole, because we are at the brink of this spiritual revolution, in the sense that we are beginning to see that a lot of religion is about dogma, but at the same time, so many people are clinging to the fundamentalist role within religion, becoming more dogmatic rather than more spiritual. And also, at the same time, those who are willing to kind of like peel back a bit of the layer, they fall for the, oh, Mary Magdalene is married to Jesus, and let's not go beyond that. So it's a very interesting thing that these powerful women are treated as sexual objects, and again, they are whores, but they are historical whores, because it is us who are abusing them, because historians do not really want to give away the idea that history is more than just a series of coincidences. What I hate about the way Anne Boleyn is portrayed, specifically, is that somehow the creation of Protestantism in the UK, in England, was an accident. Oh, it just happened because Henry slept around with a few women and all of these women were like this. As if, you know, somehow a nation broke with the Pope, tried to create something tremendously big. No, that didn't happen. We just have to accept the mistaken belief that all of this was because Anne Boleyn somehow had incestuous relationships and slept around with a few men.
Well, the thing about the Protestant Reformation in England is that, you know, the story of the women who not only inspired it but kept it alive has never really been told. And as you know, this is a huge passion for me, and this is something that we are working on every day at this moment. Anne Boleyn was not an accident of history. Anne Boleyn didn't cause the Reformation by accident. I believe that she went in there with the absolute intention of reforming England. You have to remember, and this is, again, none of the historians focus on this, mostly because it's not easy, okay? The information about Anne's childhood and upbringing is very difficult to find and very rarely convenient or written in English. Anne spends 8 years on the continent, and during those 8 years, Anne Boleyn is raised by the four most powerful women in the world, three of whom are queens. And no one talks about that. But not only is Anne raised by the most powerful women in the world, she's raised by women who are radical reformers and radical feminists. Marguerite of Navarre is called the most radical woman, not just of her time, but possibly of any time in Europe. The priests in France say that she is such a heretic that she should be tied into a sack and thrown into the river. And the reason she is not is because she is a sister of the King of France. Her point of view is so outrageous in terms of its need to reform the church that she to this day is considered an outrageous feminist and reformer. And she is a genius and a powerful personality. And we now know, when we dig into the documentation, that she had a huge influence on Anne Boleyn. Modern historians, particularly British historians, try to ignore that or gloss over it. They make assumptions that this did not happen. They say, oh, there's no proof that she and Marguerite were ever friends. But that's absolutely not true. We know that Anne Boleyn was influenced by the most radical reformer of the 16th century, because when she is in her most beleaguered state, she tells her confessor, who writes a letter to Marguerite of Navarre, saying the only thing that Queen Anne Boleyn wants as much as to have a son is to see you again. Now, let's think about that for a minute. Anne Boleyn is saying in this letter that the only thing she wants as much as a son who will save her life and save the future of England, is to see Marguerite again. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence that these women were good friends. I believe that by the time Anne Boleyn got to England after her 8 years on the continent, she was a powerful, devoted reformer, and she marched into London with the absolute intention of reforming that country. And that is the element of Anne Boleyn's personality and legacy that nobody's talking about. Nobody talks about the fact that if Catherine Parr had not been Henry VI's wife, the Reformation might not have ever survived. Okay, England could probably be a Catholic country if Catherine Parr had not done what she did, which was hold tight to the reins of reform during her legacy and raise Elizabeth. Catherine Parr becomes the only mother Elizabeth I really knows and really, really inculcates her into the Reformation. And then later Elizabeth really inherits all of this information about who her mother truly was. Elizabeth I never had any doubts about her mother's innocence, and she never had any doubts about her mother's power. And she steps into that and really creates Protestant England the way that it ultimately evolves. So that is a legacy of Anne Boleyn that nobody talks about. That's a powerful legacy of a woman with real drive and real determination to change the world. Anne Boleyn is the ultimate spiritual revolutionary. And yet she is denigrated as a whore and an incestuous witch. And that is the element of wrong that is happening today and always in the world when it comes to women in history. It's time to change that.
And I was just thinking when you were talking about that, that it's when you go and visit Scotland, St. Andrews, and Glastonbury in England, those were very powerful Catholic abbeys. They were the biggest abbeys there were around. Glastonbury was so wealthy, it defies almost belief. And when you walk around those ruins, whether it's St. Andrews and there are other places in England, you find these beautiful ruins, and you hear the story about how Henry VIII destroyed all of them because he was upset with Rome. He was upset with the Pope because the Pope did not want to grant him a divorce from Catherine of Aragon so he could marry Anne Boleyn. Well, as we're beginning to find out, the story is completely different. It's late in life, Anne Boleyn, who says the church we should give to the poor. She gave an absolute fortune to the poor. And it's she who begins to dissolve the monasteries. It's not Henry who is somehow upset and does this almost ridiculous act. This is a conscious decision. This is a woman who says, this is an old paradigm which has worldly power, and I'm going to use my position as queen to create a revolution, which is to break down the old paradigm and teach the people the truth about Jesus and the Bible. She had in her possession hidden books. She had translations in her possession of the Bible from Greek rather than from a few centuries of erroneous translations in Latin. And she is one of those people who really tried to rectify what she felt was an enormous wrong and do something good for the people. This was a woman, in short, who was educated, as you say, by the most powerful women in France, came to England to radically change that country. And in retrospect, she did. But how do we remember her? We do not remember her as a powerful woman who was able to convince Henry to do what was right for his people, to give to the poor, and to do away with the old power because it was simply unjust. She tried to change a false image as to what she felt Christianity should be like and what it was being told. And how do we remember her? As a whore. And it is so similar to Mary Magdalene or to that other great reformer, Nefertiti, who together with her husband Akhenaten felt that Egypt had degenerated to a state whereby a very small priestly elite had absolute control over the people and ruled from within the walls of the Amun Temple in Karnak, and with blatant disregard for everybody else. And she felt this was so wrong that she literally said, I will do away with this priesthood and I will go back to a time where they felt Egypt was more in balance. And they created specifically a new capital in the middle of the ancient territory of Egypt to show that there was a new balance which was being achieved, as well as the fact that what she was doing, that this was a new era which he was launching. And guess what? There was once again opposition to this idea. They were excised from the written record, but to this day, Nefertiti is quite often depicted as this beautiful woman, but also as this woman who somehow got Akhenaten involved in this crazy idea that, you know, he should do this. Well, when you look at the drawings of Akhenaten and Nefertiti, the few who survive, you see that these people were not only madly in love, they were also doing things together. This was a decision which, you know, was made by husband and wife, by Pharaoh and his queen. This wasn't anything like what we try to sensationalize. And once again, we are missing the key points, which is that spirit revolutions have happened in the past, sometimes successful, but sometimes also unsuccessful, but that in each occasion, the man quite often seems to be depicted as the buffoon who falls for a woman who somehow is able to seduce him.
While we're talking about Anne Boleyn tonight, I want to make one other point about her, which would be funny if it weren't so incredibly tragic and such a clear symbol of everything that we're talking about here today, and that is this. You can go to the Tower of London, even today, in the 21st century, and a yeoman warder will tell you this gothic horror story about how Queen Victoria had the bones of the tower dug up in search of the bones of Anne Boleyn, and they found them, and guess what? She had six fingers on one hand. You know, the Anne Boleyn ghost story about the woman with six fingers on one hand stems from her trial and the charges that were presented against her. And one of the things that was happening in Anne's time, I mean, they threw everything but the kitchen sink at her. I mean, they had to make sure that they had so much garbage dumped on top of her that there was no way she was going to come out clean. And so in addition to the adultery, in addition to the incest, in addition to the treason and all these things that they had created, the other manufactured element of Anne's trial is that she was a witch. She had used witchcraft to ensnare Henry and make him fall in love with her. And the way they were going to prove that she was a witch is that they developed these stories about her. She had moles in parts of her body. She had a goiter on her neck. And the big secret was that she had six fingers on one hand. Well, of course none of those things are true, and of course the things that were manufactured, and by the way, a lot of those things were manufactured after her death to have made it okay to have killed her. Well, of course we had to kill her. She was a witch. But this whole idea of Anne Boleyn with six fingers has endured through history, even though it's ridiculous. And so here we are in the 21st century with the yeoman warder telling the ghost story, oh, the skeleton had six fingers, when it absolutely did not. We have what is essentially the autopsy report, the analysis of her skeleton, which I think is done in 1877, if I'm not mistaken. And one of the things that is interesting in it, or for me the most interesting, is this description of her perfectly beautiful long fingers, five on each hand, and how tapered they were and lovely. And also, by the way, Elizabeth I was famous for her beautiful hands, which she often had painted in her portraits, and she said on more than one occasion that her beautiful hands came from her mother. So, small little detail, but important, because the same people who manufactured the six-fingered witch Anne also manufactured the adulterous, incestuous Anne. And you have to remember at all times that this is an invention made to denigrate a powerful woman who was a spiritual revolutionary. Viva Anne Boleyn. I am proud to walk in her shoes, and I will fight, as I said, as long as there is breath in my body, to get her true story out and to give lie to those people who have manufactured stories to make her and other women in history look like something other than what they truly were.
Because that's really what's still happening in the 21st century, which is that we are looking towards 2012 and we're asking these questions as to are we at the brink of global extermination or a wonderful thing in time? And actually the answer is, well, if these things are to happen, from a psychological point of view, we are tabloid junkies. We have dumped down. And this is something which is both there in the New Age, which is something in the tabloid culture of today. We do do not look past Mary Magdalene as to whether or not she is the wife of Jesus. We do still revel into this concept that Anne Boleyn is this trash person who seems to have slept around with everyone. We still look towards Joan of Arc, who's another spirit revolutionary who we didn't discuss, but we are sure to come back to later. She, all of these people are radically misunderstood and not seen for who they were. And we only look towards the skin of these people, just like Marilyn Monroe is always treated as if she was just this bimbo. It's a very superficial thing. And in the case of all of these women, there is a real person there who, when you give room to that real person to come out and you come up with something which really says that all of these people were extremely interesting and were trying to change the world. And I think my message is that whenever you see a tabloid headline as to six fingers, six toes, moles, or everything else to do with women or men, just think whether that is something which is really the truth, whether it really matters, or whether we should perhaps see what the person really is like inside the mind rather than just the extra digit which wasn't there to begin with anyway. Anyway, until next time, this was A Spirit Revolution.
The truth against the world. Keep fighting the good fight.